Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 12 of the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm your host, James Darley. First, I have received several emails indicating that you have been unable to post a review of the podcast on iTunes because you keep getting an error message. I have written to Apple support and hope to have an answer in the near future. I apologize for the inconvenience. As I mentioned last week, I'm going to start posting on Twitter at Historic Perform, and on Facebook, you can search Historic Performance, the guest that I will be interviewing for that week. This will allow you to interact with the guest directly and ask any questions that you may want answered. I will do my best to fit every question, but can't make any guarantees. Today, we are joined by a special guest, Paul Heckingbottom. Unlike our previous guest, Paul is not a fitness coach or sports scientist. Instead, he is an ex-professional player with over 500 first-team appearances in different levels of English football, and currently the senior development coach at Barnsley. In today's episode, we cover making the transition from player to technical coach, creating a winning mentality, his thoughts on the role of sports science, and recommendations for young players aspiring to play professionally. Great information, and with that, let's get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. Joining me from Barnsley, England today is Paul Heckingbottom. I was introduced to Paul by another Paul, Paul Bauer, who was previously on the podcast and also is part of the same club. Paul Heckingbottom is the first person to be joining us that is not specifically a sports scientist or fitness coach. He's actually the senior development coach for Barnsley. So I'm really excited to talk a little bit more about the technical and tactical aspects and how sports science fits in order to support what the coaches are doing on a daily basis. So, Paul, how are you?
Yeah, good. Very good. Thanks, James. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Hopefully we can get some good information out there for people to listen to.
No, definitely. And I think we're going to be attacking it from a different angle than usual. We're also going to be talking about, I think, what's the most important part, and it's the part sometimes that's missing when you're talking about the sport, it's talking with the sports scientists, and it's that a lot of what's being done in terms of physical preparation is more of a top-down approach. So we need to know what the tactical system is, what the coach wants from the specific players, so that we can adequately make sure that we're preparing them for the physical demands of their role within the team. So, Paul, to start us off, can you give us a little bit of background in terms of your player history and how you got you to your current role in Barnsley?
Gosh, yeah. So, I'm 38 years old now. I finished playing when I was 34. In the last couple of years of my playing career, I was coaching part-time at Barnsley Football Club with the younger age groups. So, I began my football career when I left school at 16 with Manchester United. And then moved on to various clubs such as Sunderland, Darlington, Norwich City, Bradford City, Sheffield Wednesday, Barnsley. So I had quite a few clubs throughout my career, played over 500 first team games, and then made that transition to coach as I was coming into my mid-30s. So it was pretty smooth for me, really. And it won and really enjoyed, and I was ready to pack in playing at any point to come and take up a coaching role.
I know a lot of people who played throughout their career make the transition to coach, and they have some challenges. It's not such a smooth transition. You mentioned that for you, it's fairly smooth, but were there any distinct differences that were initially shocking?
Yeah, there's definitely a change in mindset. I think what helped me was the fact that while I was still playing, I was coaching the younger age groups. So it wasn't such a big jump from one season I'm playing to next season I'm coaching. It was sort of a smooth transition. And I could definitely see the differences between playing and coaching, and playing at a professional level and coaching the youth phase. So my transition, as you say, was a lot smoother than most. I think what I do pick up on from friends who finish playing and then come into coaching is that they struggle with the mindset of coaching. So they want to take in what they've just been doing as a player, and it worked for me as a player, so let's do that with these kids. And they might be working with 14-year-olds. So what they were doing as a 30-year-old pro isn't necessarily what a 14-year-old academy player wants. Likewise, when they're coming towards the end of their career, what they were doing that they maybe enjoyed might be totally different from what another player enjoys. So that's what I think the biggest feedback I get from speaking to friends who are making that jump is understanding that just because they enjoyed something or did something as a pro, it doesn't necessarily mean that's just going to fit straight in with how they want to coach.
And that makes perfect sense, because I think many times you get used to what has worked for you and you try to pass that on. And obviously that's great. But at the same time, you have to understand, you know, what age group you're working with. So I'm glad you brought up that point. The transition now to your current position at Barnsley, you know, what are your responsibilities? What is a senior development coach?
Right. So like I said, I came in, I was sort of coaching the under 14s, under 16s on a part-time basis while I was still playing. And then I got offered the under 18s coach's job, which the title is professional development phase coach. So my daily tasks and responsibilities were coaching and looking after the under 18s, and then looking after the under 18s on a match day, overseeing their development both as a team and individual development programs. I was in that role just a few months, and then I've moved up to do the senior professional development phase coach, which is the same role but working with the clubs under 21s, which is now with the restructuring of the ECCC. That's sort of the top end of the academy from under 21s down. But how we work it at Barnsley, because of our resources and we want to try and keep the transitions between the age groups as smooth as possible, I also work with the first team. So we try and bridge that gap between an under 21 professional with me overseeing his development, but also me working with the first team. It's sort of bridging that gap then, and hopefully getting more players to jump into the first team and stay there.
Yeah, so when you're working with the U21 players, and many of them are, I'm sure, waiting and eagerly to make their professional debut, what are some of the mindset that you're trying to instill in them to tell them, hey, you know, I'm sure it's pretty nerve-wracking when they have their first team debut?
Yeah, well, that's the big thing. And that's the biggest challenge I face as a coach, and the resources we have and the politics and the setup as a football club is, I think that group, that under 21s group, should be the hungriest group, the hardest working group, and the most talented group really within the squad, because I try and send a message that they need to be above and beyond and better than the player in their position within the first team. So ultimately I try and get the message across that we have to be the best group in the club. If you want to jump and get someone's place, you have to be better than them. So that's what we try and instill. We do have difficulties in terms of resources, numbers of bodies, and just how the group is perceived as such, because it will always be perceived as less than the first team. And it is messy in terms of logistics, in terms of you're not always sure which numbers you're left with, because the first team might want some of your players, whereas the under 18s are always left alone and no one really interferes with their games program or their bodies. So they get a real consistent training program, if you like. Whereas the under 21s is constantly changing and it has to be fluid. The message, one big message we try and send across is that's good, that's all part and parcel. These are just more challenges to overcome. The fact that we might have to change our setup or our team shape at the last minute to accommodate first team players, it's great, but we have to adapt to these challenges, and it's a no excuses type mentality that we try and get across into the players.
So a lot of times the first team, those first team players are not getting tons of minutes or playing time. They'll come down to the U21 level to play almost as if as a reserve team.
That's right. Yeah. So we may have done a week's worth of game prep for the next under 21s game. And then on the Monday morning of the game, there might be three players from the first team come and join in who've not been part of that game prep, not being part of the group for the week. three under 21s players miss out. So it is, those are real big challenges and frustrations, and they are for me as a coach as well. But like I said, I can't use them as an excuse, and I can't let the players use them as an excuse. It's always going to be there, and we have to get beyond that. And if any players do come through, then they are better for the experience of it.
Would you be able to take us through a typical week that happens at the U21 level in terms of the training that you do?
Yeah. So predominantly at the minute, our games are on a Monday afternoon. So if I start you from game day plus one, we have Tuesday will usually be a recovery day. Wednesday is sort of a second recovery day. Sometimes the players aren't in on a Wednesday, so they may have the day off. On a Thursday, then we start back in training and we'll begin the training program for the next game, which will be the following Monday. So we may start touching on then the technical and tactical information. Friday would predominantly be our more physical day of the week. So again, we may integrate some tactical information in with the physical loading of the session. And we try and complement the two. So an example would be if we're wanting to do any sprint work, speed work, we may incorporate a counter-attacking element of our game so we can draw out the physical demands from the session. Friday, similar again. Saturday will be similar again, all be tactical. Maybe some technical work in the PM. Sunday, depending on the first team. Sometimes we're in Sunday, sometimes we're off Sundays. I always try and get the under 21 boys in when the first team are in, just for that exposure to the manager, to the assistant manager, to the first team players, because that's something we can't replicate as a group. We can't replicate the intensity of the first team players or just the exposure to the manager watching the players play. But that will be a very short session on a Sunday if we are in. May take the lads away and do some bit more tactical work for the game, for the opposition. And then the Monday will be the game again. I'd like to stress that. So that will be a plan. That will be the plan for the week. But as I say, at any point in any day, things can change. So we are always at the beck and call of the first team. The first team are training and want some bodies or want to do a particular thing in a training session. Then we may have to adopt what we're doing to accommodate what the first team want.
It seems to me that there seems to be, have to have a lot of communication here. Communication between the first team. And you also mentioned about making sure that specific physical capabilities are being focused on. So I'm sure you have a close working relationship with your support staff, particularly your sports science department. And Paul Bauer was on here earlier, and he said that at Barnsley, it's great because, you know, you guys have a great working relationship. So how do you go about establishing this type of rapport where the technical staff and the sports science staff come together and talk about what should be going on within a session?
Yeah, well, one of the things we're looking to have at Barnes is the logistics are good at our football club. Everybody's on one site from the first team all the way down to the foundation phase coach who looks after the under nines. So everybody's all on one site, all on corridors. So we've got access to each other, which is fantastic. The other thing the club have tried to do, and it does sometimes make my role difficult and a lot of grey areas, but the fact that I am working with the under-21s on the first team does help bridge those gaps and keep the communication smooth in terms of the daily workings. What do the first team want? And quickly accommodate that while still looking after the under-21s. So I'm sort of go-between the first team and the academy, which helps. But then the biggest pitch, I think you alluded to it a bit earlier, is the fact that we need to be very clear in what are our main outcomes. So what are we looking to achieve? And I think you have to head that up by the tactical element. So what does a Barnsley Football Club team, what does it look like? What does it play like? So everything should be born out of the tactical element of the performance model. So how does a Barnsley Football Club play? From that, what physical demands do the players need? Are they position specific as well because of the roles they're going to play in the game? What's the psychological element of the players we're trying to develop through the academy? We mentioned a no-excuses approach, so a good mindset, rising to the challenge. And these are all things that we can look to develop within our environment, within our daily environment. And the more aligned we all are in our thinking in terms of the coach being very clear in what he wants and what he expects of the players, the more you can help incorporate ideas from your sports scientists, psychologists and your medical team to try and get the best out of each individual player as well, in terms of their long-term development towards hopefully a first team place.
No, definitely. I'm glad that you reiterated that point that everything stems from ultimately the tactical system. So let's delve into a little bit more about the communication process with the sports science department. So as a coach, you know, what type of information are you looking to receive from a sports scientist to help with the development of your particular session for the day?
Yeah, so we do a lot of the wellness scores and the jump tests and things before training, which is great. I don't particularly need to see them, or I'm not, but the sports science will raise it if there's an issue. If Paul thinks that we need to be aware of someone, we can adapt the session or tailor the session to still incorporate them, but we can be well aware of them. I do have concerns, or my only concern with the whole aspect of it, though, is, again, not to contradict or not to go against anything that we're trying to promote in terms of the player's psychological development. So we want a no excuses approach, a real winning mentality. And I have witnessed amongst football clubs the fact that when we are trying to educate players in terms of their physical development, might be minutes played, the load they're accumulating through the week, things like this, we can give players, so we have to be careful not to give players an excuse to not push themselves fully, or not to perform, or something to blame a poor performance on. So I think the coach needs all the information, but we have to be very careful what we do let out and what we filter down to the players, because it can have a detrimental effect on what you're trying to achieve.
Since we're talking about mindset, and you just mentioned right now, you know, you have to be really careful what type of information you give to the players. Let's say Paul comes to you and says, hey, I really think this player, you know, is accumulating a lot of load. We should be reining him in a bit for this particular session. How do you approach a player to tell him, hey, I think you need to be doing this today rather than the actual, you know, training that everyone else is doing?
Yeah, well, it's good, and it's a good point. I think it all stems down to the player as well. I think a big part of my role is that relationship with the players, and understanding exactly what the player needs, not necessarily what the player wants, but what that player needs in order to develop the best, but also to perform the best. So some players will be told why they need to drop out, because the load has been accumulating a lot low. We need to be careful with them. One, they'll understand it, but two, I know they will never use that as an excuse for their performance. They've done too much. Other players will not even get mentioned to, or just tailor the session with the conditions or their role within a session, so that they may be out on the grass the same length of time, but their RPE for the session may be a 5 or 6 when others is an 8 or 9. The other way we can do it is we will just adopt that other player's minutes, so he may be in the session fully and contributing towards an eight out of 10 session, but he may finish on 40 minutes and go off and do some individual specific work while the other players carry on for a remaining 20. So there's lots of different ways that we do try and work with the players to control the load. But again, always in tailor with what is that player's needs, and is he a type of player who can deal with and cope with that information, or is he a type of player that doesn't even need to know it?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think many times coaches feel that when they receive this information that they need to pull the player aside and not involve them within the session at all. And what you're saying is, yeah, you can involve them within the session, but you just need to tailor it so that you adjust the RPE, because ultimately football is a team sport. So you don't want to create individualization where a particular player doesn't feel that they're part of the team anymore.
Exactly. And I think if when it becomes, especially when we get to the top end, so under 21s, we try and promote that winning mentality. But ultimately, their next step is results business. So their performance matters. The result on a Saturday matters. It's about getting the 3 points. So you have to make sacrifice, and some of that might be performing when you're not physically at your best. If you want to have a career in the game, you have to know how to manage yourself when you're not your best. You have to know how to still perform when you're not your best, and you have to know how to win games. So at some point, players may be stressed and overworked for on purpose. So it is important that we are in control of what the players do. Again, I'm probably going off topic a little bit now, but a comparison I give and why I think it's important is you alluded to the fact that it's a team game. I think if you've got an individual athlete who is at the top of his sport or profession, generally they have got the best mindset to be in an individual sport at the elite, at the top. You have got the psychological capabilities to succeed and be successful. So I think those individuals are more equipped to cope with all the information. They tend to make better decisions, and they will never use it as an excuse. They use it to get better. Whereas in a team sport, like football in particular, my experiences are that not a lot of players can use all that information to the best of their ability. A lot don't understand it, and a lot, in my opinion, don't even need to know it, because it would just become something else to worry about or something else to blame poor performance on.
The reason that I'm glad to have you on is because many times I feel that when you're talking with other strength and conditioning coaches or sports scientists, the main emphasis is always on programs, loading schemes, energy system development. And sometimes when we're so focused on that, we forget that ultimately, you know, it's the team's role to go out there and win. I mean, especially at the professional level, everyone's livelihood depends on it. I mean, if you have a terrible season, well, chances are that both you and the support staff is going to get sacked. And when we're talking and we're visualizing that, we need to make sure that this winning mentality is being instilled. And I think that is really a key point that you mentioned within this conversation.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's the biggest thing when you're talking about elite sport, because it is the be all and end all. Another way of looking at it would be, if you're looking to develop a team or individuals towards a team, or individuals already within a team, you've got the technical development, tactical, psychological, social, and physical. So you've got five elements there. Predominantly as well, when we speak as or with the sports scientists, they're speaking about one specific domain out of the five, which is the physical domain. And that's great, and it's terrific, and you want to push the sports scientist to be as good as they possibly can in that domain, in that development. But it can't be to the detriment of one of the other four domains. And I think that's the coach's role, is in tying everyone together. And we, going back to the other point, it is, if you've got a performance model at the top of that, everybody knows where they fit within the picture and what their role is in terms of developing that performance. Because when you get them all, if you add the five domains working independently and all doing sports science, looking after the physical development of the player, what would make him physically the best? The psychologist doing the same, the coach technically, tactically, and socially, then you can begin to contradict each other's work, send mixed messages, and ultimately that's where poor performance would come from.
Yeah, and having played in college myself, I know that, and you having played at the professional level, I'm sure we can both agree that the worst thing that can happen is when all of a sudden you have different coaches contradicting one another, because it's really confusing for the player.
It is, definitely. And I think maybe a more damaging thing is those messages that are sort of sent implicitly, where the environment created, either through mixed messages or people working against each other, not intentionally, but if we're not very careful, or the coach is not very careful in aligning everybody's roles towards the common goal, then these messages or the environment is fighting itself. And that can probably be a bit more damaging than a coach giving a contradictory remark to another coach, because that is easy to deal with. You know, you can easily sort that out. But if you're not aware of the contradictions within your coaching environment, then that can be very damaging, because you can never put them right.
Exactly. Just to continue with the sports science aspect of it, one final question I have about it is, many times I feel that sports scientists and strength conditioning coaches, they're unsure in terms of what type of information the coach wants, especially at the beginning of the relationship. So just from your personal opinion, you know, what type of information do you feel that isn't necessary for you to know from the physical side?
Yeah, I'm probably a little bit different to, like, part of my studying and when I was coaching as well as getting my FA coaching badges, I actually went and studied an undergrad degree and then a master's degree. So I like to develop a good knowledge of the sports sciences. So I like to have all the information and have discussions with the team, sports science team, the psychologists. I enjoy getting that information. And I think it's important that I do have a good knowledge of it. So like, so we can keep everyone on task and everybody knows that they're working towards a common goal. So I enjoy having the information. But also in my short time at Barnsley Football Club over the 4 years I've been here, I do see how damaging it can be when a coach receives information that he necessarily doesn't understand and then it's used in the wrong way to try and coach or cajole a player into doing something that can be damaging or that is not necessary. So I think sometimes a sports scientist has to have good skills in terms of which information he passes over and also how he gives it. So sometimes I think a sports scientist can lead if they think they know, are very confident in how they can give information. I think they can lead in how they give it to a coach or to a manager and sort of take the lead in that aspect, because I've not seen too many sports scientists do that. And I think that's a very valuable skill to have.
I'm really happy that you pointed this out, because it's great to get your perspective. And I'm sure a lot of the listeners that are out there, especially because I get a lot of listeners who are just starting off their career, this is going to be some invaluable information for them to hear the other side.
Yeah, definitely. It's like anything, really. When you go in, you have to understand the context in which you work first. So me, if I change roles now and move to another football club, I've got to figure out the environment I'm working in very quickly if I want to give information in a good manner and an effective manner. So understanding the context in which you work is huge. Then developing, and someone starting out, developing the right professional skills, social skills, and communication skills, that's massive. It's probably discussed more in coaching qualifications than it probably is in sports science qualifications, but they are valuable tools to have, and you must understand them, and you must understand how to get your point across and which information you're going to give. So in terms of people who are starting out in any sort of professional role or club, I think that is big advice and something that they need to understand.
I actually want to touch upon last season, because last season, for the tail end of it, I believe you were made interim manager for the first team, if I'm correct, along with another individual.
Yeah. So we one manager left. So good experience for myself. Like I say, straight away, I was working in a different context. I've gone from trying to win games, but a development coach as such. So I would try and develop a winning mentality than win a game of football as such in an under-21s game. And then all of a sudden, you have to win the game. Now, if an under-21s coach has brought players into a first team with the winning mentality, then that should be easy. But when you're stepping into someone else's shoes or someone else's group, you have to have an immediate impact. And I found it really good, really interesting, and really enjoyable.
Yeah, the reason I want to highlight that is because I don't think I'm going to probably get another individual here who has been in a managerial position of the first team. And I can probably imagine that at first it was a little bit nerve-wracking, as you said, stepping into an individual's shoes with a group that luckily knew you from your senior development part, but still you're not interacting with them on the same level as probably the manager who left was. So what were some of the challenges that, you know, being in that role? What were some of the stressors?
Yeah, really, in terms of the coaching and the players, I found all that really, really easy and comfortable, and it's something I enjoy doing. Obviously, what changed straight away, again, is the context in which I'm working. So straight away, then we're accountable to an owner and a chief executive and a board of directors in a different way than we were 2 weeks previous. So all of a sudden, all that becomes different. So again, the politics of it and the environment in which you work. And that really is the only difference. In terms of the coach, what I try and do anyway daily is build those relationships. But just if I'm honest all the time and I work towards my values and beliefs, then I'm never really going to change regardless who I'm working with. obviously our outcomes may change in terms of winning a game of football, but how I go about it and the relationship with players won't change. But the actual politics of it and dealing with management, managing upwards, is a big one. And that's sort of something that's changed as my roles have changed. That's something that I've become more aware of. And something, again, my communication skills, my social skills, and what information I give and how I give it becomes more important. And that's why I would always pass that lesson on to people, that it's an invaluable tool to have.
No, definitely. And I just want to make a transition here, because also some of the people that listen to this podcast are some of the students at my university where I help with the strength and conditioning. So a lot of them are young players. They're currently in college, and many of them are thinking of moving on or trying to make an attempt to move on to the next level. So I think it would be great to hear a bit from you, since you're a professional player in England. You know, what piece of advice would you have for a young player just trying to make that transition to become professional, that you wish someone had given to you when you were just starting out your career?
Yeah, it's funny, it's different. You look back now and I tend to realize what managers or coaches were trying to tell me when I was playing, and you tend to not listen. So the things how I try and coach, there's probably three things which are non-negotiables in my training sessions or when I'm working with players, and they know them now. So it's the fact that they must always want the ball. So whatever session we do, you always want the ball. I want to promote that risk-taking mentality, and the fact that you can only get better if you've got the football. So always want the ball. Always work as hard as you possibly can. So get the maximum out of every session. And that might not be physically running about everywhere, working as hard as you can, but might be on a technique, on a skill, on a challenge. So work as hard as you can to master a skill. And then the second one is about respect. So your teammates, yourself, and the group. So are we respecting each other as a group of players? Are we all giving everything to make each individual better? They'd be the three things which I'm quick to jump on with players, because I think if they want to evolve and I want to promote that no excuses mentality, then that's what they've got to be aware of, taking that ownership and that responsibility for their own development. So those three things, the wanting the ball, hard work, and being respectful, are massive. And I think if a player has naturally got that, then he's got a great chance.
Yeah, I mean, those are three really great aspects. And I think part of it is also just not hard work when you're on the pitch, but it's hard work outside of it, especially when you're probably dealing with the U21s. You have to also instill good values in them in terms of, you know, what proper sleep is like, what proper nutrition is like. And a lot of the times people think that's in the realm of the sports scientist, but I also think it's an important role that the coach plays.
Exactly, yeah. And we're back to the mixed message again. If the coach can back up what is important physically and back up the message from the sports science, then straight away you're adding a lot more weight and value to the sports science's role. And that's key, and that's probably those three few things you've mentioned there, probably the biggest changes since I was a player. I enjoyed playing. I thought it was a terrific lifestyle, best job in the world to play football. But when I left in an afternoon, I weren't a footballer anymore. I was a dad, husband. I went and enjoyed my life. I didn't necessarily live the life of a footballer, but I think now it is a lifestyle. If you want to get the most out of your career, you have to live the lifestyle of a footballer in terms of your diet, nutrition, sleep, recovery, preparation. It's key, because a lot of players are doing it, and if you're one that's not, then already you're falling behind. Again, I'm very conscious linking that though to the game again, that players don't automatically think that if they do everything right, they'll turn up and play well. They still have to have the right mentality, the winning mentality, and be quite ruthless in effect if they want to be successful and they want to be part of winning teams. So if you've got someone with the correct mentality and the knowledge and the belief and the drive to get the physical preparation right, then I think you're onto a winner.
For some of the coaches that are listening out there, you know, what type of importance do you think that the physical side actually plays? I know, I'm sure that changed significantly when you started off your career to where it is now, in terms of the gym-based work that's going on, the injury prevention. Do you feel that it's particularly important?
Huge, massive, big. I'm a big believer in it. I mean, my last league game, I actually packed in when I was 31 in league football because of hamstring tendon problems. And I know now, with what I know from coaching and medical teams and how things have progressed, that I could have easily sustained my career in the league another 4, 5, 6 years. Basically, when I packed in and I took over and did a proper strength and conditioning program for myself, all my injuries cleared up. I know I weren't playing first-team football at the same time, which people would argue, yeah, but you never know. But I know that if I'd have done the correct things while I was playing, especially towards the end of my career, I would have prolonged my career another few years. So I know it's massive. I think as well, I'm big on mentality. You probably guess I've been speaking about it a lot, but that will only get you so far. So I know I could go out, or a player could go out on the pitch feeling under the weather, being ill, having poor preparation, but he can still go out and be the man of the match. But if his preparation or he's ill and over a long period of time, he's got no chance, he won't sustain it. And that's where your physical preparation and development is key. It helps you sustain good performance over a longer period of time and hopefully prolong careers.
Since we're on the topic of mindset, and part of what this podcast does is try to give information to those who are just starting out. And in this case, it'd be those that are trying to become a coach in the sport of football. So yeah. What advice would you give to someone who's just starting their career in order to make sure that they're developing the qualities to be the best coach possible? And what resources could they use in order to understand how to manage people and how to instill winning mindset in them?
Yeah, good point. I mean, everybody says, and when you're on football coaching qualification, everybody promotes learn, and it's right and it's correct, but it's generally about the game, and you do have to learn about the game. You have to be very clued up on the game, test yourself to see trends and things happening tactically in a game. I think that's fantastic and I enjoy doing that, but that's only one element. You need to learn how to coach, so the coaching process, which my academic studies helped me with tremendously, a lot more than the FA coaching qualifications. So that gave me a big insight. It helped me learn about the sports sciences, the different domains of sports science, and I enjoyed it a lot. You have to learn about your players, so your group of players that you're working with, whether they're younger players, older players, professional players. Again, what are their wants and needs? And the wants and needs might be very different from each other. And is it elite football where you have to focus on the needs and you know what's best for them to get the best out of them? Or is it just recreational and you're looking after players' wants and giving them the enjoyment and everything that they need that way? So there's lots of things to consider, but perhaps the most important one and the one I pass on to most coaches is you've got to learn about yourself. You've got to know what's important to you, what are your values and beliefs, and then how do they affect how you coach? So certain things that will be my beliefs and maybe make me prejudice against someone's performance or their ability to learn or develop, I have to be aware of them. Otherwise, that's going to impact on my decision-making and maybe I can make bad, worse decisions if I'm not fully aware of how I see things compared to everybody else, because you can't presume to think that you're right all the time. And no one else's opinion matters. So you have to be very aware of all your biases, prejudices, and values and how they impact upon your decision-making as a coach.
If I understand correctly from what you said there as well, it's you have to use your experiences to create your own coaching philosophy?
Definitely. I mean, basically, what is coaching? It's getting a message across, to teach and learning, and you have to understand what works for which athlete in what circumstance and why. And that is our job, really. I think anyone who says they are this type of coach is kidding themselves. You have to be able to do what works for who in what circumstance and why. And the more skilled you are, and the more experience you get, and the more willing you are to listen and experiment, I think you're more likely to get it right.
So for someone starting out, your recommendation would be to get as much experience as possible, because I'm sure you have the feeling that a lot of this you can't really learn through your qualifications. You actually have to learn by interacting with people.
100%. And I think that's one of the, when, especially ex-professional players, that is probably the one mistake that they make. They go through the course, begin on their coaching journey with the coaching badges through the FA while they're not coaching. And they expect that when they can just finish playing, get a couple of badges and then go and coach. And if you're thrown in at the deep end like that, you're going to come unstuck. And unless you're a quick learner, people are going to see through what you can't do. So go out and get the experience. Go and coach. Go and see what works for you, what you're comfortable doing. Where are the gaps in your knowledge and your skills? Where you need to get better? And like you say, you can only do that through experience and going out and trying it.
Do you think that, for example, an ex-player who is getting their licenses and they've never been in a coaching setting, should they be starting off with kind of coaching youth before they move on to perhaps coaching some of the higher levels of the academy?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, not everyone. Everyone's different. Again, same with coaching. Some coaches, some successful football coaches, managers will have never coached youth or academy football or kids football, and they probably wouldn't be suited to it. But then there's others who do, and I can only speak from my experience. I know it helped me coaching within the academy to start with, different aspects and different methods of coaching where you can be experimental, when you can understand how people learn, and it's not just straight away about results. So my coaching journey would have took me through developing individual development plans, team development, so creating good teams. And then as you step up through that, it becomes about this development, but towards a winning mentality. And then in my time looking after the first team, then it's about the results. So I've experienced a lot of it, and definitely the working with young players and coaching within the academy, especially when I first started out, helped me massively.
Yeah, I'm glad you put in that point that it's going to vary from person to person. But I think a point that I definitely want to highlight that you just mentioned is the fact that you're able to have a bit more experimentation rather than if you're thrown in the deep end of the pool. You know, it's very result driven. So you can't really experiment and create your own coaching philosophy as quickly, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing I've noticed now when you're getting up in working with first team players is a lot of good coaches or a lot of sound coaches or good teachers were working with the kids in the academy over the last few years. But now these boys who were in the academy experiencing this type of coaching are now in first teams in places, and they are demanding that little bit more knowledge from a coach, a little bit more tactical understanding or a way of delivering. And I think there is a shift changing now in terms of senior management, older managers, and dealing with these younger players coming through who have experienced a different way of coaching within an academy system. So methods of play now that have been shown in first team, that you can see in first team, which maybe managers or coaches would have been scared to try a few years ago, have been going on within the academy system for 5-10 years, and now it's filtering through. One, because the coaches are filtering to first team positions. Two, because the players are capable because they've been coming through. And three, because it is a little bit more accepted now and it's not so off the wall. You don't tend to, it's difficult to be the first one to try and do something different. And now it's become more practiced and accepted in the academies. Now you've seen a bit more variation in how teams play at first team level.
Paul, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was great information here. I'm really glad that I was able to get you on board. And I just want to thank Paul Barra one more time for helping us get in contact with one another. It was a massive learning experience for me. I think it's one of the best podcasts I've had so far. And so thank you very much.
No problem, James. Thanks for the invite and good thank luck you. With everything. Cheers, James. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another Historic Performance podcast. I really hope you enjoyed the content today. I thought it was extremely informative and a bit different from previous podcasts. I also appreciate the continued support via social media. Every single week, I see more shares happening for the episodes, and I see people being engaged from different parts of the world.
This week we had someone download from Colombia, another person from India, and yet one more person from South Africa. So it's really a great testament to how international soccer is and just where this information is getting to. So thank you very much for all of your support, and see you next time.